right now, 60 minutes. Start your watches. First of all, topic one, we calculated the spectrum of zeta yesterday. I just wanted to say a few words to give a physical picture of what exactly we were calculating there. How does it relate to observations? Full story, unfortunately, is too complicated to go through in the 5 minutes I have allotted to this topic at this point. But nevertheless, we can get something across here. Then we want to discuss the traditional introduction to quantum field theory and curved space time in terms of Bogle-Yubov transformations. So the idea is just that in normal quantum field theory, the vacuum is unambiguously defined. As soon as you go into curved space-time, that's not true. Even when you try to do free field theory in curved space-time, one observer's definition of the vacuum, one observer's definition of the state with no particles in it, differs from another person's definition of the state with no particles in it. Depending on what coordinates they choose or what part of the space-time they happen to live in. So that's basically another way to say what goes on in inflation. And the idea of inflation is exactly that, that the definition of the vacuum that you would naturally choose if you were an observer living in the far past is different than the one that you would choose today. And you could say that the way inflation produces fluctuations in the early universe is that the universe started off in the vacuum state defined by an observer in the far past. That's the hypothesis, basically. And that whereas we interpret that state relative to the vacuum that we define today, and we interpret it to be a state that does have particles in it, does have fluctuations in it. And then third, we want to see the connection between basically horizons, temperature for the accelerated observer in flat space, so that's the Unruh effect, and for black holes, and for De Sitter space. All those spacetimes have horizons that radiate at a temperature that you can. There's a single slick. You may find it too slick. Let's say it's almost mysteriously slick, but that probably means that there's something good about the argument. Slick argument to get the temperature for all of these guys associated with all of these horizons in one simple go. So we want to understand how to do that. The idea is to interpret. Well, we'll get there. Okay. So first things first. Yesterday, we took the most direct, practical route. If you go into cosmology and you have a new theory of the universe, you want to calculate what primordial perturbation spectrum it produces. Like, let's say it's some modification on the single field inflation model that I showed that we were talking about yesterday. The most direct way to calculate the actual observable that you compare to data is the calculation that we went through yesterday. So we calculated some power spectrum for zeta, and what was the result? It was something like 1 over 2 times the slow roll parameter epsilon times h over 2 pi times the Planck mass squared, where the idea is that we have some co-moving wavelength, and in co-moving coordinates, it has a fixed size as the universe evolves, but the co-moving Hubble radius comes in from some huge sphere at early times. The universe accelerates and accelerates and accelerates. This becomes tiny. And then radiation domination takes over, and the universe decelerates, and the Hubble radius grows up into the present day. So the idea is we have this fluctuation here, Initially, it was very small relative to the Hubble scale. It was very small relative to the curvature radius. It was so small. It's like you being on the sphere and only being able to measure around you a region very small relative to the radius of that sphere. You'll think you live in flat space. This mode thinks it lives in flat space. We give it the ordinary. We put it in the ordinary vacuum as defined by an observer who thinks they're living in flat space here. But then, okay, suddenly its wavelength is getting closer and closer to the curvature scale. Something happens here. The mode, quote unquote, goes outside the horizon. And we calculated the resulting spectrum that somewhere here, somewhere when it's well outside the horizon. This is the so-called primordial power spectrum. The power spectrum, once these modes have gone outside the horizon, prior to the right, it's sort of, you can take this as the initial condition for the subsequent decelerating radiation-dominated, matter-dominated epoch, the normal Big Bang part of the Big Bang model. So the perturbation spectrum here, the power spectrum, is given by this, where these two time-dependent quantities, H and epsilon, are changing with time in general as the universe is going through inflation here. But for a given mode K, in this formula, we're supposed to evaluate these two quantities, H and epsilon, at this moment in time when the mode crosses the horizon. Okay, so this in some sense should be epsilon sub k and h sub k, the values of those two quantities at the moment of horizon crossing. Okay, and then what happens? Well, the universe begins to expand, and at some moment here, the CMB photons are released to us. Okay, let's say this is the moment when the cosmic microwave background is released a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang. So as you see, at this moment, if you have a short wavelength, sufficiently short wavelength, it not only left the horizon during inflation and was outside for a while, but then here it crossed back inside the horizon. And by the time the CMB photons were released, it was short relative to the cosmological scale again. It once again was back to thinking it lived in Minkowski space. Okay? So for these guys, if you want to relate this perturbation spectrum to the actual temperature fluctuations they induce in the cosmic microwave background, the story's too complicated for me to go into here. Except the basic idea is the reason it's more complicated is that we had this picture before where the background dark matter density was creating potential wells and potential peaks in the gravitational potential, and the gas of protons and electrons and photons began oscillating in and out of those gravitational potential wells. Okay, so if you want to describe these short wavelength guys, you have to include effects like that. We just didn't have time in this class to go into those in detail. But for these guys out here, for the wavelengths that are long enough that they started inside the horizon during inflation, then they left the horizon at some point during inflation, they were outside, and then at the moment that the CMB photons were released, they were still outside the horizon. Well, what happens is that, remember, we had derived another formula for this, or we had written it on the board, and you're deriving it in the homework. Another formula for this, the precursor formula to this, had looked like this: just some constant k cubed over some constant 2 pi squared, and then times this time-dependent function, this function that represents a solution of the square of the kth Fourier mode solution of the zeta classical equation of motion. So remember, zeta had some classical equation of motion, which we really quoted it on the board, and you'll derive it in the homework. But it had some equation of motion like this. We said it was a damped harmonic oscillator equation of motion, except it's the opposite. It goes in the opposite direction. And the previous damped harmonic oscillator we had talked about when we talked about inflation rolling down the hill, or we talked about the non-thermal relic, we had drawn a scalar field like this, and we said, in the normal decelerating phase, that scalar field starts up here, initially overdamped, pinned on its potential, and then when H drops enough, when the Hubble rate gets slow enough, it becomes unpinned by Hubble friction and becomes underdamped and starts oscillating. Here, this equation of motion, well, we're not in the decelerating phase, we're in the accelerating phase, so it's the opposite. Initially, this mode is way inside the horizon. This term is negligible, it's underdamped, it's oscillating. But at later times, once it goes way outside the horizon here, as long as it's way outside the horizon, this mode is negligible relative to these guys. The solution of this equation is zeta is equal to a constant. So what happens is that outside the horizon, this expression just remains constant all the way from when that mode left the horizon up until the CMB photons were released, because at the time the CMB photons were released, the mode was this sufficiently long wavelength mode was still outside the horizon. Okay, so in that case, there is a very simple relationship between what we calculated here, the statistical properties of zeta that we calculated here, and what you actually see in the cosmic microwave background. And to see what that is, to just sketch what that is, you can see it as follows. Remember how we defined zeta. Remember how we defined the perturbation zeta yesterday. We said we decomposed the metric in the ADM form. So we wrote it as, we decomposed it like this, where there was the time part, and then there was the three metric gamma ij on the spatial slices times and the three metric, which was the thing that carried the physical perturbations, was, we wrote it as a squared of t times e to the 2 zeta of x. This is a space-time dependent perturbation. This is just the unperturbed scale factor. And then times e to the 2 hij. This is the gravitational wave perturbation. So we'll just take this guy to be, those are negligible. We haven't detected them yet. So we'll take the limit where hij is 0, in which case this just becomes delta ij. And this thing, again, we said this overall function with no indices in front, we can just interpret as, if zeta was 0, it would just be reduced to the scale factor. When zeta is non-zero, it has some little space-time dependence. This is some space-time dependent effective scale factor, a squared of t and x. Okay? So according to this formula, if zeta is a little bit bigger at some point in space, that means that the scale factor has expanded a little bit more. The effective scale factor has expanded a little bit more at that point in space. The scale factor expands a little bit more. That means the density and the temperature have diluted a little bit more at that point in space. So you're just going to see at a spot on the sky where zeta is a little bit bigger, where the statistical fluctuation carries zeta up, you'll see the temperature a little bit colder at that spot on the sky, and vice versa. Okay? And so this simple explanation only applies to these long wavelength modes. So you have to imagine, you look at the cosmic microwave background, you squint at it. You look at a map of the cosmic microwave background, you squint at it, you blur your vision so much that you can't see any structures on scale smaller than 1 degree about. Okay, 1 degree. It turns out modes that are too short to behave this simply are about 1 degree on the sky today. So you blur your vision so you can't see those things. The rest of the blurry map has that interpretation, that the random function zeta that you calculated is just literally represented by the temperature fluctuations on the CMB with essentially no change. If you calculate the two-point correlation function, you know, how does, what given the value of the temperature fluctuation here, in other words, given the value of the zeta fluctuation here, you know, how does that affect the likelihood of the two-point correlation function of zeta or the temperature fluctuation here? You calculate that correlator as a function of the distance between the two points. The Fourier transform of this is just what the power spectrum is. Okay, the power spectrum of a fluctuating function is just the Fourier transform of the two-point autocorrelation of that function. Okay, so that's all very brief, but I just wanted to give a flavor. Just wanted to make sure that we got a flavor across. I mean, the main point to take away is that there is a calculation that you can do in the early universe that is quantum mechanical, but very simple. It's really just literally the most direct extension of free field theory to the case where the background space-time is expanding. You just apply that to the hypothetical accelerated expansion in the early universe, and with not a lot of effort, and you, as you'll see in detail on the homework. I mean, with not a lot of work, you get this nice expression, which then directly describes and successfully describes the statistical properties of the temperature fluctuations at large scales in the CMB. And you have to go through more rigmarole if you want to describe what the smaller scale fluctuations are doing. But you go through that rigmarole, and those are described correctly too. Okay? Check. I think that's all. Do people have questions about that, or that's maybe all I'm going to say about that first topic. Really just trying to get across the flavor. I know that if you were asked tomorrow to calculate the spectrum of temperature fluctuations in the CMB, that presentation might have been too fast to equip you to do that with full confidence. But I think that's the best I can do. Okay, topic number two. There's another conceptual way to say what is going on here. So schematically, let's just talk about what we do in free field theory. If we have a free scalar field phi, just a real scalar field phi, it obeys some equation of motion, some like Klein-Gordon equation, del phi plus m squared phi is equal to zero, where this, what is this guy? Here, what I mean by this is the operator, box is the operator, minus g mu nu. So it's like the Laplacian or the D'Alembertian. I always forget exactly what this guy is called, but it's the natural Laplacian operator on curved spacetime. Okay, so we have some second order differential equation, and what do we usually do? Like, let's say in Minkowski space, what does this become? This becomes minus or plus plus d squared phi dt squared, and then minus d squared phi dx squared plus m squared phi is equal to zero. And so what we would usually do is to solve this partial differential equation, we would do a spatial Fourier transform to convert it into an ordinary differential equation. So the spatial Fourier transform would convert this term. So these guys would all become phi sub k vectors. And this would become plus k vector squared. Grad squared would be converted into a plus k vector squared, where k is the wave vector. So now we have an ordinary second order differential equation. It has two solutions. What we usually do is we find one of those solutions, phi sub k e to the I. So then adding back the e to the I k dot x that we Fourier transformed out, we get one solution like this. My notation is just confusing. So the full space-time dependent solution corresponding to that Fourier mode is this guy, so if the wave vector was ki, instead of calling this ki, which is what I was tempted to do, which will just be, because I mean, I'll just call it phi I, okay? And so then, if I take for every wave vector k, I get a solution like that. I can also take it. So in Minkowski space, this guy would just be e to the. An example would be that phi sub ki would just be e to the minus omega t. Omega I t, where omega I would be the square root of m squared plus k vector I squared. So I have my solution phi I, which is in the Minkowski case I is conventionally chosen to be just writing this guy out explicitly is conventionally chosen to be e to the I k vector dot x minus omega it. And then I take my scalar field, I take my full field, and I quantize it by writing this guy as some sum of these solutions, phi I, times a coefficient which gets promoted to an operator, the annihilation operator, the corresponding annihilation operator A sub I. And then to make this field real, I have to add the complex conjugate of both of these things. So this is, phi I here is a space, phi I is just some space-time dependent function. It's a solution of the classical equations of motion. It would just be this in Minkowski space. But then the coefficient is an operator. And to make the whole thing Hermitian, I have to add the Hermitian conjugate of this. So I add another term that's like AI dagger, phi I star of x. Okay, and again, as we sketched on the board in class yesterday, and as you'll check on the homework, you know, the usual story is that when you work out the canonical commutation relations for a free field phi, so basically phi commutes with phi, and its canonical momentum pi commutes with pi, but phi and pi, when they're at the same point in space and time, do not commute. Okay, the equal time commutation relations. Again, we said those are equivalent here to the creation and annihilation operator commutators, the familiar commutators from the simple harmonic oscillator, basically. That A commutes with A, and A dagger, any A dagger commutes with any A dagger. But that if I and J are the same, that A and A dagger do not commute. Their commutator is equal to 1. Okay, so far so good. And then these guys, you know, these sort of commutation relations you go through the standard calculation that you've seen for the simple harmonic oscillator. These commutation relations are the things that give us the normal interpretation of each of these modes as representing a particle. That the state space is that you can have n particles of type 0 and n1 particles of type 1, etc. And that this state is obtained by acting on the vacuum, the Fock space vacuum, with the zeroth creation operator to the n zeroth power times the first creation operator to the n oneth power, etc. And then if you want to measure, if you want to know what is the observable that actually measures the number of particles of a given type in your given state, it's, if you want to measure the number of particles of in state ni, the classic result is that you take the operator AI dagger AI, operate on the state with that, and its eigenvalue is exactly the number of particles you're trying to measure, n sub I, in that state. Okay, so that's the usual picture. Seems very straightforward and simple. So what goes wrong in curved spacetime? Well, it's just that when we were writing down phi here, we made some choice. So we took the equation of motion for phi and we Fourier transformed it. And we had an ordinary differential equation. But it's a second order ordinary differential equation, so it has two linearly independent solutions. And we chose one of those solutions, and then we took its complex conjugate to be the other linearly independent solution. Okay? That's what we're doing. But that was important. I mean, that we put the annihilation operator in front of the one of the solutions, and we put the creation operator in front of the complex conjugate solution. You know, what if we all couldn't agree upon which guy which linear combination of the, we have two linearly independent solutions. What if we can't all agree on which linear combination of those two solutions to put the annihilation operator in front of, and which linear combination to put the creation operator in front of? So it's, so that's the situation in general relativity. So why is it, first of all, not the situation in Minkowski space? Normally, this problem doesn't crop up in Minkowski space. We choose a convention all physicists agree on some convention. We say we're going to take the solution with positive frequency, meaning the solution that goes as this solution. Normally, we're just in... We take the positive frequency solution where omega is double, is a positive number. We take that, we put the A's in front of that. We just by convention choose our annihilation operators to go in front of that guy. And we choose our creation operators to go in front of the other guy, the guy with the other sign. So in other words, the annihilation operators, according to usual quantum field theory, goes in front of the solution where, you know, if you sit at one point in space and look at the and follow this complex number, you know, it rotates as e to the minus I omega t. It rotates clockwise in the complex plane. If you just sit at a fixed position x and follow the complex number as a function of time, it rotates in the clockwise direction, whereas this guy rotates in the counterclockwise direction. Okay, and then now suppose another person flew by. They did a Lorentz transformation that converted their, you know, they described the same function with some new coordinates x prime mu, which is some Lorentz transformation of your coordinates x with no prime. Well, you know, the usual story is that they'll see a new k, they'll see the same function but with a new k prime mu that's related to yours by the inverse Lorentz transformation. You know, it transforms depending on whether you write the mu up or down. I haven't written it in covariant notation there, but you know, the basic story is that k mu is a four vector, contravariant or covariant four vector. They just see the same. They see this. They also see a plane wave in their coordinates, just with k mu converted to a new k mu. But a Lorentz transformation will take a k mu that has a positive energy. You know, any Lorentz transformation, if you start with a k mu that has a positive energy omega, and then you Lorentz transform this guy to this guy, this guy will also have a positive, will still have positive energy in the new frame, and so the new observer will agree that this wave is a all inertial observers in Minkowski space will agree that you've split this up. You'll agree on how to split this up. They'll say this is the wave that's rotating this way in the complex plane. This is the wave that's rotating this way in the complex plane. So you all put creation and annihilation operators in front of the same splitting, regardless of your state of motion in Minkowski space. So in GR, it's just not true. To take a simple example. Imagine a Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe in which you put in whatever matter is needed to make the scale factor A of t. So if I plot A of t as a function of t here, the universe starts off with A of t just a constant, some constant. So it looks like, for all the world, just like Minkowski space. The universe is just homogeneous and not expanding. And then, okay, matter turns on. Universe expands for a bit and then becomes constant again at a bigger radius. And so now, if you just solve, we will not do this, but if you just solve the wave equation in this space-time, you put in a mode that is, let's say, purely positive frequency, e to the minus I omega t. Here, you take a particular wave vector, k vector, and now you solve for its time dependence, subject to the boundary condition that it's purely e to the minus I omega t here. So it's purely positive frequency over here. You follow it through, it'll stay e to the minus I omega t, but then It's like scattering from a potential barrier in quantum mechanics, that you send in a mode, but you get a linear combination of modes on the other side. If you just solve this equation, regardless of what shape the bump has, at the end of the day, you'll have some linear combination over here of alpha times a part that goes, some coefficient alpha times a part that's going as e to the minus I omega t plus some coefficient beta that's going as e to the plus I omega t. So in other words, these people will genuinely differ on their definition of how to split up the field into creation and annihilation operators. The late time observer and the early time observer in this example will differ, and this is exactly what happens in inflation. The scale factor doesn't have this exact behavior, but the same basic idea is true, that at early times you start with modes that are very small relative to the curvature scale of the universe. Then the curvature scale shrinks down relative to those modes. So they begin to feel that something is going on. Then the curvature scale grows again, becomes huge relative to those modes again. They think they live in Minkowski space again. But exactly this sort of behavior happens. A result I'll just quote for you. I'm not 100% sure whether to have you do it on the homework or not. It's very easy, but I don't want to pile too much stuff in the homework. Let's just imagine you have your field, and okay, one observer at one part of the spacetime thinks it's natural to decompose it like this. They take annihilation and creation operators times some solution set, some basis of solutions ui. Okay, times they have ai times u times the functions ui, and then ai dagger. The creation operators times ui star. But then there's some other observer, maybe with a different state of motion or maybe in a different part of the space-time, who for whatever reason finds it more natural to decompose the field into operators and basis functions with a bar over them. A different choice. There must be the U's and UI's form a complete set of form a complete basis of functions phi of x, and so do the U bars. So we can expand one in terms of the other. Let's imagine that we expand out the U's in terms of the U bars. So there will be some coefficients here in the expansion. Okay, so the coefficients in front of the u bars, I'll call alpha ij. The coefficients in front of the u stars, u bar stars, I'll call beta ij. The idea is that repeated index j is summed over here. I'm just not writing the sum out explicitly. So if we just take this expression, plug it in for ui, and we can also take the complex conjugate of this expression, get an expression for ui star. We plug it in for ui star here. So we'll get two terms here. Now we can just, after we plug that in, we have this whole expression rewritten in terms of, instead of u and u star, we have u bar. We have it written in terms of, we get four terms that each have a u bar or a u bar star. We collect the u bars and u bar stars to compare to this expression. So let's imagine just plugging in here and collecting terms. So what do we get? Let me just, to speed up the process, let me make sure I don't screw things up here. We get the term proportional to u bar is like that. And then the term proportional to u bar star, and that should be a j. And the term proportional to u bar star is like Okay, but just comparing here, we see that just comparing this expression to this expression, so the in this expression, the coefficient of u I bar is nothing but the operator ai bar. So this whole coefficient here is nothing but what we were previously calling ai bar. This whole coefficient down here is nothing but what we were previously calling ai bar dagger. So now, what if we just demand? We in order for this to be consistent, you know, we want these a's and a daggers to obey the normal commutation relations for creation and annihilation operators, you know, in both frames. So let's say we assume that the a's satisfy this condition, but then we demand that the transformation preserve that condition, that it really is true that both observers have an equal right to call their expansion an expansion into particles and creation and annihilation operators. So then, you know, we have now an expression for A bar in terms of A and A dagger, and we have an expression for A bar dagger in terms of A and A dagger. So we can demand that our A bar expressions satisfy the usual commutation relations. So we take these expressions and plug them in for A bar, use them to eliminate A bar and A bar dagger in favor of A and A dagger. But then we already know the commutation relations for A and A dagger. Those are these by assumption. So we find that taking those by assumption and requiring that these also be true imposes some conditions on beta and alpha, but they're conditions that allow for plenty of solutions. So the conditions, it turns out this guy gives you that beta dagger alpha. If I just interpret alpha ij, if I just rewrite it in matrix notation, so alpha ij I'll just write as the matrix alpha, beta ij I'll just write as the matrix beta. Then beta dagger alpha has to be equal to beta dagger alpha transpose. Okay, so beta dagger times alpha has to be a symmetric matrix. And this guy just says that alpha dagger alpha minus beta dagger beta transpose is equal to the unit matrix. Okay, so so alpha and beta have to obey some conditions. But you can check that still allows for plenty of solutions. So there's a huge ambiguity in principle between different ways of splitting up the field into modes and their complex conjugates, which is perfectly consistent with the particle interpretation, with the ordinary Fock space interpretation in terms of creation and annihilation operators. And then so the final thing you can do is you can say, well, what is the measure of whether I really have, by splitting it up in these two different ways, I really have two different vacua? You know, have I really defined two things that are physically inequivalent from one another? So normally, so the person who uses the unbarred modes, the unbarred annihilation operators, he will define a vacuum state in the usual way. He'll say it's the state that's annihilated by all of his annihilation operators. Another, the person who uses the unbarred modes will say, no, the vacuum state is the state annihilated by all of my annihilation operators. Hopefully they are causally disconnected, or they will be able to communicate this disagreement to one another, and then they will feel a great deal of stress. They will, you know, I mean, hopefully for their own mental health, they're causally disconnected from one another, because imagine what it would be like have someone communicate something like that to you. Okay, but so the main thing I wanted to say, again, I'm sitting on the fence a little bit about whether to actually give this as a problem. So I'm not 100% sure yet whether I'm going to put this on the homework. But if you construct this guy's number operator. So ni is equal to ai dagger ai, and you ask, you know, what is the number of particles in his vacuum? It's zero, of course. But if the other guy takes his notion of particles represented by his number operator, n bar, constructed from his barred annihilation creation annihilation operators, and evaluates it, then what you'll find is that it's just the result is the II component of the matrix beta dagger beta, which in general is not zero. So in other words, the physical reason for splitting alpha and beta here is that if two observers decide to decompose their functions into compose their field in different ways into a basis of functions, well, as long as beta ij is zero, they can mix up their u's with their u bars as much as they want. There's no actual physical consequence of that. They'll agree on the definition of the vacuum. They won't disagree on how many particles are present in the spacetime. But as soon as they begin to define functions that are an admixture of functions of the opposite, as soon as their positive frequency functions include some admixture of someone else's negative frequency functions, that's when the trouble occurs. Okay, so it's all contained in beta. And so again, in the simplest cosmological case, where we just divide into Fourier modes, and each Fourier mode has an individual time-dependent coefficient. What we're talking about here is we put in a mode like we do in inflation. We put in a mode that's purely positive frequency at early times. That was an implicit choice we made yesterday. If you look at our calculation, when we were defining the vacuum, we took a boundary condition in the far past, which was the normal vacuum state defined by an observer in the far past. It would have a purely positive frequency guy for the function that multiplies a. But then if we follow it through the spacetime to the end of the day, to today, we find that it's a mixture of what you and I today would call positive frequency and negative frequency modes. And so today we will say that whereas this person said there were no particles with this wave number in the early universe, we will say, no, there are. We expect, the expectation value that we expect to find if we measure the number of particles in that mode is the absolute value of beta squared. Okay? So again, yes?
Sorry, I think I missed something over here. When you wrote the last line, the beta dagger beta components, mm-hmm. zero, whatever, where did you get that from, just using the ni bar is equal to the bar of the creation annihilation operator?
I am going to put it on the problem set. That makes it sound like you are. I was going to put it on the problem set anyway, but I was feeling this went by a little bit too fast. That was a causal. I had decided that in my mind before you asked that question. Yes. So what am I saying here? So. Ni bar 0, 0. Okay, I'm putting on the problem set, but I'm also doing the problem set before your eyes. Here we go. So that's Ai bar dagger Ai bar 0, 0. So now 0, I know, is annihilated by A, but I don't know that it's annihilated by A bar. So before I can evaluate this expression, I have to replace the A bars here, which I don't know anything about, with their expression in terms of A, so that I can tell what this expression does to the vacuum state that's actually sandwiching it. So I plug in, I replace A bar in that expression with this expression, some complex number coefficients alpha and beta times A's and A daggers. Every time, so now I have an expression with four terms in it. There's an AA term, an A dagger term, an AA dagger term, and an A dagger A term. As usual, whenever there's an A on this side, it annihilates this guy. Whenever there's an A dagger on this side, it annihilates against this guy. So the only term that's left here is the term when I got, where from the linear combination here, I took an A, and from the linear combination here, I took an A dagger. That's the only term that doesn't get annihilated. Then that this thing is equal to 1, and so the only thing I'm left with is the coefficients. Well, if you look at what the coefficients are, it's like there's a beta ij and a beta ij star. So this whole thing is just rewritten as trace, is the ij component, and I'm summing over j. So this whole thing is the is beta dagger beta, the ii component of that matrix. Okay. So now again, I think that's all I wanted to get across. I'm really itching to get to the so that I knew I realized that's a rapid sketch of that second topic, and I also am too short to check it off, but consider that second topic checked. And so now finally the third topic, which I think is very fun, and okay, so there's this fact that you may have heard, or I don't know whether you've seen it derived anywhere in your course, but this fact that like somehow being in thermal equilibrium is the same as a state that's in thermal equilibrium is a state that is periodic in imaginary time with periodicity beta is equal to 1 over kt. You ever heard that statement? Oh, that's very. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for reminding me. And thank you very much. Let's see. So the pressure is so high. Hold on. That joke is not appropriate. Oh no. I forgot to, usually I have to rack my brain to remember a joke, and I forgot to rack it ahead of time. There's one. It's really so nice of you to ask for a joke, by the way. That really warms my heart right before the end of the course, that to actually be asked for a joke. I've been feeling like I've been clubbing you with the jokes and then dragging you and clubbing you again. You've made my day. Man's neighbor comes over and he asks to borrow his horse. The man says, sure. So the neighbor borrows the horse. A long time passes. He doesn't give the horse back. And so the man goes, at some point, goes to the neighbor's farm, which is a ways away, and knocks on the door and says, I'm just wondering if you've had a chance to use the horse for whatever you were going to use it for. Could I have my horse back? And the neighbor says, I'm so sorry, the horse is actually dead. And the man says, I don't know why you didn't tell, but anyway, meanwhile, he's coming to grips with that. He hears, neigh, neigh. He hears the horse neighs in the yard, and he goes. The man says, that's my horse back there. That's my horse. Why did you? And the guy says, the neighbor says, oh, so who are you going to believe, me or the horse? No. That seemed like a little strong element of courtesy in that final laugh, but I'll take it. As I say, at this point, I feel nothing but gratitude. Why is being in thermal equilibrium like living in a space-time that is periodic in the imaginary time direction? So, remember, like, there's two approaches to quantum mechanics. If you started with some state psi naught, you could either, in the Schrodinger picture, you evolve that to some state psi of t by evolving it with the time evolution operator, e to the minus iht. But then there's another equivalent picture. So psi of t appropriately. Okay, but then there's another equivalent picture, and then the operators don't. Let's say you have an operator A. It doesn't evolve in time; it just is. And then you calculate the expectation value of A at a given time t by sandwiching the time-independent operator A between the time-dependent wave function psi. But there's an equivalent picture. You can just regard the in the Heisenberg picture, so this is the Schrodinger picture. In the Heisenberg picture, you would just regard the operator A. You would just pull the time evolution operator off of the state and onto A here. So you regard the state as evolving in a way that it would if you pulled the time evolution operators onto it. You say A of t is the time independent operator evolved in this way, and the state just is. It doesn't evolve with time. And then again, you calculate the expectation value of A in the same way. You sandwich the state. You sandwich the operator between the states, but now the time evolution is here. But it's easy to see that the expressions are exactly the same. You'll get the same answer either way. So all your observables behave the same way in either picture. Okay, so we're going to work in the Heisenberg picture, I just wanted to say. So what we mean by a thermal state is then, instead of working with a pure state, you're probably familiar with this other approach where you can specify a more general state, a mixed state, by giving its density operator. So, if you have you can have a bunch of pure states. And they can be mixed up in some particular way, with complex coefficients here. So it's more general. If we just had a matrix that just had one, that there was some basis where one of the diagonal elements was one, and then the whole rest of the matrix was zero, that would be the density matrix representing just the pure state psi I. But this is some considerably more general object. So among this set of more general objects, a thermal state is a state where if you decompose in a basis of energy, if the psi I's are energy eigenstates, each basis appears in this sum, but with a proportional but with a weight, with a probability that is proportional to its to the Boltzmann factor. So it's thermally, so it'll be some factor like this. So we sum over all I here. Okay, and then divide by the partition function to normalize it. But anyway, it's irrelevant. So in other words, another way to say that is just that the thermal density matrix is just e to the minus beta h, where beta is 1 over kt. Okay, this is just equivalent to this formula. And really what I should really do is divide this by the partition function in both cases to get the actual expression, where the partition function is just to make sure that the trace of this thing has to be 1, because the trace of this, so to get the trace of this thing to be 1, we just define, we define that trace to be the partition function zeta and divide by it. Okay, so now in this language, just a slight generalization of this guy. Now the expectation value of an operator at any time in the density matrix language is just the trace of the expectation value of any observable A, or any operator A, is the trace of the density matrix describing the state of the system times that operator A. And let's work in the Heisenberg picture and assume that rho is the thermal density matrix here. Okay, so that's 1 over z e to the minus beta h times a of t. Well, a of t in the Heisenberg picture is some operator a times e to the iht e to the minus iht. So, but now suppose that so if we want to evolve this operator from time t naught to time t naught plus t, this is the resulting operator in the Heisenberg picture. But now let's just imagine that instead of evolving it in the real time direction, we evolve it. We imagine that we can now evolve. We just formally extend t to the complex domain, and we perform the time evolution here with this formula. But taking t to be imaginary, and in particular, let's evolve it by an amount t which is equal to I beta, plus or minus I beta. Okay, let's see. So let me just make life a little bit easier. Let me take it to be plus I beta. Okay, so then this is e to the minus, let me take it to be minus I beta, sorry. It'll work either way, but okay, I'm just being dumb. So then we have e to the minus beta h. If we plug in minus t equals minus I beta here, this is e to the plus beta h, so these two terms will just cancel, and we'll get a t0 times e to the minus beta h, and this is all traced. I dropped the trace by mistake here, but remember we're taking a trace of everything. Okay, so the trace is just cyclic, so I can move this operator over to this side with impunity, and I'm back to my original expression. Okay, so in other words. Okay, is it clear? If I move this guy over here, then I'm back to the original expression, which was 1 over z times e to the beta h, so that's the thermal density matrix, times a at time t0. So in other words, what we've shown is that a, the expectation value of a, evaluated at any time, plus an imaginary increment I beta, is the same as that observable evaluated at the unincremented time, its expectation value at the unincremented time, provided that the density matrix of the system is the thermal density matrix. Yep?
We didn't need to take t equal to that, right? You could just commute them away. For example, use a cyclic property to, so the second line exponential of minus iht, right?
Oh, now wait a minute. Why is that happening? Hold on one second. Wait. I must be doing something wrong. Hold on. Yeah, you're just saying I can commute this guy through here. So funny. Wait a minute. What am I doing wrong? That does make it look like it's periodic under any shift in imaginary time, but that is certainly not true. What did I do wrong? $10 to whoever can see first what I did wrong. What did I? What am I doing wrong here?
Isn't it independent? Because the thermal equilibrium, thermal state is time independent, right?
No. Now the answer is definitely no, but the reason for the answer is crumbling before me. Okay. Oh no. 5 minutes over already, and now my whole justification is screwing up right in front of me. Okay. It's the last lecture. I can't come back to you in the next lecture with the right answer. I'm gonna have to figure this out. So your point your point looks true. H commutes with H, and so it looks like those guys commute right through each other. What am I doing wrong? Okay, to not keep you over any longer, I'm going to not figure out what I'm doing wrong right here. But I will say the statement is true. The statement is true. I'm just screwing up the argument. So it's not true that the thermal state is invariant under any translation in imaginary time. It's periodic under translation in imaginary time by I beta. So if you the whole point of this argument is that now we're going to use the same phenomenon in reverse. We're going to say if a space-time exhibits periodicity in imaginary time, like if we look close to space-time horizons, we'll find that they will have some periodicity in imaginary time. And using that, we will be able to slickly read off by finding that periodicity and setting it equal to beta, we'll be able to slickly read off the temperature of that horizon. Under the assumption that this is true, so it's the in other words that you could calculate the temperature of the horizon in various ways. You could calculate the so for example, So the first case that we'll consider is just ordinary Minkowski space. One observer just takes ordinary the inertial observer just takes natural Minkowski coordinates x and t here, and they have a normal Minkowski. They have a normal definition of the Minkowski vacuum. There's another. Let's now consider this wedge, this 45-degree wedge here, and consider the following coordinate transformation. So let's switch from, let's call these capital X and T, the Minkowski coordinates. So in terms of Minkowski coordinates, oh man, I ran out of time. I'm just going to do the Unruh case, and then again, maybe or maybe not. There have to be very hard decisions made about what to put on the problem set. There's so much good stuff. Oh man. It's killing me to leave some of these things off the problem set. Okay, so, but then it would be killing you to put them all on the problem set. So consider the following coordinate transformation. I'll be done in just two minutes, 3 minutes. Let's take x to be little x times cosh of some constant a times t, and let's take capital T to be little x times sinh of the same constant a times t. So if we plot these coordinates, then the curves of constant x are hyperboloids here. Okay, that if I draw them correctly, they all asymptote to the light cone as you go out in this direction. But they don't cross each other. and the curves of constant little t. These are the curves of constant x here, and the curves of constant little t are lines like this. Okay, and so each of these hyperboloids is the trajectory of an observer with constant acceleration. So observer with constant acceleration travels along a curve of constant little x, and their proper time is proportional to constant little t. Okay, so the capital X and T coordinates naturally describe inertial observers in Minkowski space. The little x and t coordinates naturally describe accelerating observers in Minkowski space. It's a natural accelerating foliation. So if we just take dx and dt here and plug it into this expression, we get, I was going to actually calculate it, but then, so let me do, so I didn't write down the expression. Dx cosh at plus x sinh at adt, and then similarly here, so if we just take, if we square this guy and square this guy and plug into this formula, then looks like we should get d little x squared minus a squared x squared dt squared, I believe. Does that seem right? Pretty sure that's right. That looks right. Okay, so now the statement is the following. Let's look at what this metric looks like in imaginary time. Okay, so let's replace t by I tau here just to look at things more clearly. So then it looks like dx squared plus x squared a d tau squared, where tau is equal to it. Okay, but this is nothing but the Minkowski metric written in polar coordinates. This is nothing but the Euclidean two-dimensional plane, dx squared plus dy squared. If we take dx squared plus dy squared, and then we just switch x and y to polar coordinates, x and y is equal to r cosine phi sine phi, then dx squared dy squared becomes dr squared plus r squared d phi squared. So this looks exactly like that, with x, with the r over here, the radial coordinate being the coordinate x over here, the direction in this case along which we're doing the accelerating. Okay, so this is nothing but the flat space metric rewritten in polar coordinates, but in order to have that interpretation, this guy here, a d tau, is d phi. But we know what d phi's periodicity is. It's 2 pi. So a d tau, a d tau has periodicity. I mean, a tau has periodicity 2 pi. So tau has periodicity 2 pi. Tau has periodicity 2 pi over a. But then according to the interpretation that I was supposed to derive for you, and promise is true, this periodicity should also be interpreted as beta, i.e. 1 over kt. So we derive this famous formula in this way for the unrho temperature, that an observer who is accelerating. So if Minkowski space is just in the vacuum, but you turn on your rocket so that you move with proper acceleration A, all the measurements you make, it will seem to you that you're living in a space-time that's not a vacuum space-time, but that is in thermal equilibrium with some temperature T. So if you turn on your particle detector, you'll be detecting photons with a Planck distribution whose temperature is given by A over 2 pi. And now you can just do exactly the same argument if you just zoom in close to the horizon of a black hole, or you zoom in close to the horizon that's around you in an accelerating De Sitter space-time. Again, you find that if you just take the time to the imaginary direction close to the horizon, that the metric, once again, the RT part of the metric, looks just like the flat Euclidean plane, but written in polar coordinates. By identifying the polar coordinate with phi and giving it period 2 pi, in each case, you can read off, it's the sort of slickest way to read off the temperature of the associated horizon, which you could calculate in a much more complicated, grueling fashion by, you know, actually calculating the Bogle-Yubov transformations relating the positive frequency functions that would be defined by the capital Tx observer and the little Tx observer. You can calculate it that way, but it's just a big mess. This is a much slicker subsequent way to calculate these things, pointed out by Hawking and Gibbons. Anyway, I should really stop there. I apologize for running over. I apologize that the whole justification argument for this final slick method of calculating is at the moment in a state of complete disarray. Anyway, I have to go clear up my mind about that and fix that point. But anyway, thanks very much. Sorry for running over. Go do something great, I hope.